Shiva Sudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 6, Text 16. Is it on the board? Yes. Vidvana Pitam Dano Jakutumbam.
Vidvana Pitam Dano Jakutumbam.
Animal. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. O my friends, sons of demons, in this material world, even those who are apparently advanced in education have the propensity to consider, this is mine and this is for others. Thus, they are always engaged in providing the necessities of life to their families in a limited conception of family life, just like uneducated cats and dogs. They are unable to take spiritual knowledge. Instead, they are bewildered and overcome by ignorance. Purport. In human society, there are attempts to educate the human being, but for animal society, there is no such system, nor are animals able to be educated. Therefore, animals and unintelligent men are called vimudha, or ignorant, bewildered, whereas an educated person is called vidvan. The real vidvan is one who tries to understand his own position within this material world. For example, when Sanatana Goswami submitted to the lotus feet of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, his first question was, Ke ami kene omaya jare tapatraya? In other words, he wanted to know his constitutional position and why he was suffering from the threefold miseries of material existence. This is the process of education. If one does not ask, who am I? What is the goal of my life? But instead follows the same animal propensities as cats and dogs. What is the use of his education? As discussed in the previous verse, a living being is entrapped by his fruitive activities, exactly like a silkworm trapped in its own cocoon. Foolish persons are generally encaged by their fruitive actions, karma, because of a strong desire to enjoy this material world. Such attracted persons become involved in society, community, and nation, and waste their time, not having profited from having obtained human forms. Especially in this age, Kali Yuga, great leaders, politicians, philosophers, and scientists are all engaged in foolish activities, thinking, this is mine and this is yours. The scientists invent nuclear weapons and collaborate with the big leaders to protect the interests of their own nation or society. In this verse, however, it is clearly stated that despite their so-called advancement or advanced knowledge, they actually have the same mentality as cats and dogs. As cats and dogs and other animals, not knowing their true interest in life, become increasingly involved in ignorance, the so-called educated person who does not know his own self-interest or the true goal of life becomes increasingly involved in materialism. Therefore, Prahlad Maharaj advises everyone to follow the principles of Varna Ashram Dharma. Specifically, at a certain point, one must give up family life and take to the renounced order of life to cultivate spiritual knowledge and thus become liberated. This is further discussed in the following verses. Vidvana pitam danujakutumbam pushnam svalokaya nakalpate vai yasya parakya vibhinna bhavastama prapadyetu yata vimudha. All my friends, sons of demons in this material world, even those who are apparently advanced in education, have the propensity to consider this is mine and that is for others. Thus, they are always engaged in providing the necessities of life to their families in a limited conception of family life, just like uneducated cats and dogs. They are unable to take to spiritual knowledge. Instead, they are bewildered and overcome by ignorance. Mukham kroti bachalam mangam langayate grem yat kriparitam mande shri guru nina tadanam. So, the word vidvan means an educated person. The root is vid. From the same word we get Veda and Vidya. And it comes into modern Western languages in such words as wisdom, same root. But there are two kinds of vidya or education, knowledge, material and spiritual. So the material knowledge is, or material vidya, is actually tarka. Tarka means material logic, which is just argumentation back and forth. The authority behind the arguments are simply pratyaksha and anuman, gross sense perception, and mental speculation. This is the authority. So it is declared in Mahabharata, tarko apratishta, that this type of material knowledge has no ultimate basis. It is ephemeral. It's ever-changing. Actually, the basis is simply on the skill, the argumentative skill of different persons. Prabhupada points out that someone will become established as a great authority on the basis of his ability to make good arguments, but he will be, in time, defeated, or even not defeated, even not that, just that people get tired of hearing his arguments. And gradually they become interested in someone else's arguments, even if that someone else didn't actually defeat the first person. But just in time, someone else's arguments become fashionable. And then this becomes the vogue, to think in this way. And then, I think it was Max Planck, this famous German scientist, who pointed out that scientific theories do not replace one another on the basis of proof. But rather just it becomes fashionable that younger generation of scientists, they become advocates of some certain view. And as they grow up and take over, then that view becomes predominant. And then the next generation comes along. And because it is natural for younger people to think, especially nowadays in Kali Yuga, to think differently from their elders, then that younger generation, they adopt a different view. And as they grow up and the old ones die off, then that becomes the predominant so-called scientific outlook. So this is actually the process of so-called knowledge. Therefore, tarko apratishta. It actually has no solid foundation in reality. So the real truth, dharmasya tattvam nihito guhayam mahajano yena katasa panta, the real truth, the real confidential knowledge of Vedic Shastra is to be understood from the Mahajana, the realized souls in whose hearts the Dharmasya Tattva is established. So, Mahajano Yena Katasa Panta, to attain factual vidya, factual knowledge, one has to simply follow in the footsteps of the Mahajans and not speculate. The speculation, another example, just like if we, actually I was thinking of writing it on the board, but I think I can explain it. You take the letters that spell, is there a pen? No, okay, forget it. Just try to explain it. If we could write on this board the letters that spell the phrase God is nowhere, and we just cram these letters together, then we could have a big argument here how to divide these words. You'll find in these letters that a sentence can be formed: God, Hare Krishna, God is nowhere. At least that'll wake everyone up. You can drop some more things. It can be divided up, these letters, as God is nowhere, or God is now here. The same letters. And so there can be endless arguments. What is the proper way to divide? To divide these letters, and what sentences should be formed? And this is on the platform of Tarka. This is the unending argument between atheists and theists. Theoretical atheists and theoretical theists. It's just like that. Someone is saying, no, it is God is nowhere. God is nowhere. And the other one is saying, God is now here. Like that. But this is not established on any, on anything except argument. So there's no conclusion. The real conclusive truth is found in the hearts of the Mahatmas who are seeing God directly, as we were quoting last night, Pratyashavagamam Dharmyam. The truth of Dharma is to be seen directly. Susukkam Kartamavyam, and this is the proof. Susukkam Kartamavyam. The proof is the experience of transcendental bliss, which, as the Lord says in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Rasavarjam Rasopyasya Param Drishtva Nivartate. By this higher taste, then one's senses are naturally, automatically checked from engagement in ignorant activities. One who is, despite his theoretical position, whether theist or atheist, but one whose senses are uncontrolled. This is the point being made by Prahlad Maharaj in this verse. That there are many people in this world who are considered to be vidvan, educated or in knowledge, whether atheistic knowledge or theistic knowledge. But in their practical life, it is seen that they're acting like cats and dogs. So therefore, from Vedic point of view, they get no credit. They get no credit for being men of knowledge. So knowledge is seen in how one behaves. I think there was Aristotle. Aristotle said there are three ways in which you can try to convince someone of something. Pathos, logos, and ethos. And of these three, the ethos is the most important, is actually the effective way to convince someone. Pathos means by passionate argument, by like the politicians do, by making impassioned speeches, just trying to rouse a person's emotions, basically, for a thing. So that can be effective, especially in a sleepy Bhagavatam class. If we start to shout, then everyone opens their eyes. There's some response. But better than that is logos, is by reason. That's more convincing. But the best is ethos. Ethos means example. So this is acharya. Acharya may also speak in an impassioned way. But more than that, he is using reason, Vedic evidence. But more than that, he's teaching by example. He is showing practically the way by which everyone can come to the transcendental position. We heard that last night. It's very simple. Yare deki taraka Krishna upadesh. Very simple formula. We want to become established in this Raja Vidya, Raja Guhyam, then go out and preach. Someone may say, well, but I don't know what to preach. I'm not at all educated in spiritual knowledge, but we heard in the purport, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And like Kali Santaranya Upanishad says, Iti Shodashikam Namnam Kali Kalmasham Nashanam Natta Pratarupayo Sarvavedeshu Drishyati. In these 16 syllables, Sarvavedeshu Drishyati, all Vedic knowledge is compressed. And in this Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is all the potency to overcome the evil influence of the Kali Yuga. So one simply goes out and chants Hare Krishna and advises people to chant Hare Krishna. And by his example, convinces them to chant Hare Krishna. And that person is established in dharmasya tattva, in the truth of the Vedic culture, Vedic knowledge, Vedic dharma. He's actually a transcendentalist. So this is a very simple, sublime formula. This dharmasya tattva means pratyashavagamam dharmam, direct perception of the bliss of Krishna consciousness. Krishna is the Anandamaya Purusha, the personification. That doesn't mean in an impersonal sense, but he is the personification of absolute happiness. So one who is in contact with Krishna will experience this transcendental happiness. So there was one sannyasi who was preaching at the edge of a village under a tree. And he was speaking very nicely about God, about Krishna. And the villagers were coming and hearing every day. But there was one young man, up-to-date young man, who was naturally very skeptical because this is the fashion today. So the young man came to one lecture, and then in the middle of the lecture he began to protest. He was speaking always about God. But where is this God? I don't see him. Show me God. I can see this and that movie star. I can see this and that pop star directly. I can see this and that political leader directly with my own eyes and hear him with my own ears. But you're speaking of God, and I don't see that God. And yet you want us to surrender to this God. You want us to change our lives and become devotees of this God. This is not reasonable. So I demand you show me God right now. So then the sannyasi began to explain. It is not so easy to see God. First of all, your senses must be purified and you must follow the process of sadhana bhakti. So this way he was speaking very nicely. But the young man was very impatient and again protested. No, no, no. I don't have to follow any kind of sadhana to see film stars and pop stars and politicians. They make themselves available directly to my senses. So you say the whole world should surrender to God, so then God should appear before us. This is only reasonable. Show me God. So again the sadhu, he replied to this very calmly and reasonably, but the young man was growing more and more agitated. So finally, the sadhu said, all right. He said, I think it is time, he addressed everyone, I think it is time that I applied a therapeutic method to help this young man understand what I've been explaining here today. And this is called the Kamandalu cure. So as you know, a Kamandalu is a sannyasi water pot. So this sannyasi, he had a big brass water pot next to him. And he called the young man up, please come here. I want to apply the Kamandalu cure to you. And this way, you will be able to better understand my message. So the young man, being of a scientific attitude, this sounded like an experiment, so he came forward. And he was expecting something like the sannyasi would take some water from the Kamandalu and do something with it, make him drink it or sprinkle it on his head. But as he came forward, came close to the sannyasi picked up the Kamandalu by the handle and smashed it over his head. So hard that he was bleeding, he fell down on the ground, and he was screaming in pain. Then the young man jumped up and raised a whole hue and cry that this sannyasi is a brute. He's not a sadhu. He's a thug. He's a criminal. Did you see how he just attacked me? Look, he broke my head open. I'm bleeding. And so he went and got the police. And the whole thing was brought before the judge. So the judge had before him then the young man and the sadhu. And he asked the young man, what had happened, and the young man presented his side of the story and explained how the sannyasi had, without warning, hit him over the head with his kamandalu. Then the judge turned to the sadhu and said, "So this young man accuses you of attacking him and brutalizing him. What do you have to say about that?" The sadhu said, "No, I made myself very clear before the whole village that I was applying a therapeutic method. This was therapy called the Kamandalu cure. I made that very, very clear." And the young man stepped forward to receive the cure. I don't know why he's complaining. So the judge said, "Well, that is a reasonable response. What do you have to say about this, young man?" The young man said, "What kind of cure is this? This is nonsense. He put me in such misery, such pain. My head is still hurting. Oh, how can you call that a cure? He attacked me. I almost died from the shock and the pain." So then the sadhu, he turned to the young man and said, "You keep speaking of this pain. Well, what is this pain? What is the proof that you're in pain right now? Why don't you show the judge your pain? Show the judge this pain. Give him the evidence." And the young man turned to the sadhu and said, "What are you talking? Pain is not something you just take out and show. It's something you experience. Don't you know what pain is? I'm in pain. I feel this pain." And the sadhu smiled and shook his head and said, "Yes. Now you're also starting to understand how it is that one experiences God. God is not something that you take out and show, but it is something you experience. So you're experiencing pain. You know that you're in pain by direct experience. So I know there is God by direct experience. And there is a way for you to experience God too, just like there's a way for you to experience pain, the Kamandalu cure. So I can give you another kind of cure by which you will experience pain, God. But you must accept this cure." So then, hearing this explanation, the young man became quiet and he thought about it and he found that this was very reasonable. Yes. So, yes, pratyashavagamam jarmam. This is the education. The real education means to become educated in the direct experience of God. And this is accomplished by following in the footsteps, following the achar of the acharyas. The achar means behavior, practice, as well as the theoretical knowledge. Also the theoretical knowledge of God, it is important to understand. It means accepting, first of all, that there is a purpose to everything. We see everything now around us. We see that there is a world full of discernible objects of senses. So transcendental inquiry means to accept, first of all, that all of this has a purpose. If it has a purpose, then there is someone who gave it a purpose. That is Krishna. This is called the teleological argument. This is the proper way of philosophical inquiry. In Greek, the word telos means purpose. So this teleological also is translated as argument of design. So it is the inquiry accepting that everything has been designed, everything has a plan behind it. And so we have to simply understand who is that plan maker. This is the Vedantic line of inquiry. Atato Brahma Jignasa, to inquire into what is Brahman, what is the source of everything. And the speculative inquiry, which does not bring one to the absolute truth, is trying to understand what is real and what is not real on the basis of my own sense perception and mental speculation. So this type of philosopher, his principle is, first of all, to detach reality or existence from any higher purpose. He does not admit. He says that is beyond our understanding. We don't know if there's any higher purpose. Simply try to figure out by your own perception what is true and what is false here for us. So that again is the process of Tarka, endless argument. Someone will say, well, I think this is right and this is wrong, or this is true, this is false, this is real, this is unreal. And someone else will say, no, I think this is true and this is false. And this is why the arguments never come to an end. But in the method of inquiring into the cause of everything, Srila Prabhupada said, this is that the actual quest for knowledge, to inquire what is the cause of everything, from where does everything come. So that can be practically realized, directly perceived, when the things of this world are actually engaged in the service of that cause. Then their true nature becomes self-apparent. Susukkum kartam aviyam. What is that? Srila Prabodhananda Saraswati says, Avishvapurna sukayate. I see the whole universe filled with happiness. This is the vision of the devotee who sees everything engaged in Krishna's service. And so this is preaching. Preaching means to make that understanding, that knowledge perceptible to everyone. This is the purpose of this Krishna consciousness movement. To churn the ocean of nectar, to churn the ocean of bliss, by engaging everything in Krishna's service. And thus anyone who comes in contact, even those in the darkest mode of ignorance, if they come in contact with this systematic engagement of Krishna's energy in Krishna's devotional service, they will taste this bliss, this happiness directly. And this, by the strength of this happiness, they will be lifted up out of the grip of the senses and mind to the transcendental platform. All right. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions? No? Yes? Not this. Are there... Before he starts his comments, are there any questions? Just want to make sure. Yes.
Why does this atheist, since there is equally a possibility for cosmic existence and his non-existence, why does he choose the non-existence?
Because he's a demon. The demons, Prabhupada says at the Upanishad, the demons have a twofold program. The first step is to establish the belief in the world that there is no God. So this is their trick to persuade everyone to give up standard religious practice and become atheistic and thus weakened by sense gratification. Because when one gives up God, then what? Naturally, he becomes irresponsible and engages in sinful activities. And by sinful activities, he becomes weak, both physically and mentally, and of course, spiritually. And then, having persuaded people that there is no God and having made them weak, the next step of the demons' program is to establish themselves as God, as the absolute authority in this world, so that all these persons now weakened by the spread of atheism will follow them blindly. So this is their motive. This was seen in the communist culture, that God was officially denied by the government. All religions were considered simply... I actually have a dictionary. It's called the Dictionary of Philosophy, which was published in the Soviet Union in 1967 by Progress Publishers, which was their propaganda arm. And so it's a very interesting book. So when you look up religion, it begins, the explanation of religion begins with religion dash. Fantastic, hallucinative ideology, which is used by imperialists for exploiting innocent people, the opiate of the people, like that. So they write off religion as being hallucination that was seen in the communist system. And yet, they were putting forward their Lenin and Stalin and Mao Zedong as being the absolute leaders. Practically, they were God. Even now in North Korea still, this Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, his son, they are the, what do they call them? They have some very, great leader, yes. The great leader, they're addressed by so many titles which portray them as being perfect authorities. In other words, God. So this is their program. Any other questions? Okay. Yes. I guess so.
In the book called Analogy Mahatma, Bhagavad Thakur, it's actually described that the heart is like an 8-petal lotus. And inside that heart is something called Antara Akash, which is a sky. It's actually a sky within the heart. And that sky, just like this external sky that we see, has inside of it the heavens, the sun, the moon, everything is there within this internal sky. So sometimes, and I'm not making any definite theories about this, this internal antarakash somehow or other is duplicated outside in the greater sky. So my observation over the last week is that's what's occurred here in Bamako. Last week, on Sunday, the sky within our hearts was very, very bright and sunny in the anticipation of the arrival of a very special person. And then, as manifest in the external sky, was that beautiful, clear, warm feeling that we were having, that wonderful anticipation of the arrival of our ever well-wishing friend, Sahuja Swami. And all the boys were chanting and dancing. And then Sunday came and went, and then Monday came and went, and Tuesday came and went, and Wednesday came and went. And we're all dancing under the happiness of our good fortune. But then, after Wednesday, the heart started to cloud, feeling the impending departure and separation. And then on Thursday, it was very, very cloudy and bitter. And then yesterday was the most bitter day of the week, because we were feeling in this way, inside. But then we were also thinking that we should not be selfish. We should not allow our, if this is really happening, this phenomenon of duplication. We don't want departure of our dear most friend to be under inauspicious dark and foreboding clouds and winds. So we're hoping also that we have to suppress this so that he can leave under nice, auspicious skies. And now we see. But we couldn't completely dissipate our gloom. tried. And so there's still some grayness in the atmosphere. We apologize for that.
I think this comment has something to do with what I said in yesterday evening's class. I said, Yare deke taha kaha, whoever you see, you talk about, but not about the weather. Krishna Upadesh, talk about Krishna. So I think there's some relationship. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Gaur Premananda. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskritya naram chaiva narotamam devim sarasvatim vyasam tato jaya mudirayat. Before reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is our very means of conquest, we should offer our respectful obeisances unto the personality of Godhead, Lord Narayan, unto Nara Narayan Rishi, the supermost human being, unto Mother Saraswati, the goddess of learning, and unto Srila Vyasadev, who is the author. So this morning we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 13, which is entitled Dhritarashtra Quits Home, Text Number 2. In purport by His Divine Grace, Sisi Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. After asking various questions and becoming established in the transcendental loving service of Lord Krishna, Vidura retired from putting questions to Maitreya Muni. Purport. Vidura retired from putting questions before Maitreya Muni when he was convinced by Maitreya Rishi that the summum bonum of life is to be finally situated in the transcendental loving service of Lord Sri Krishna, who is Govinda, or one who satisfies his devotees in all respects. The conditioned soul, the living being in material existence, seeks happiness by employing his senses in the modes of materialism, but that cannot give him satisfaction. He then searches after the supreme truth by the empiric, philosophic, speculative method and intellectual feats. But if he does not find the ultimate goal, he again goes down to material activities and engages himself in various philanthropic and altruistic works, which all fail to give him satisfaction. So, neither fruitive activities nor dry philosophical speculation can give one satisfaction, because by nature, a living being is the eternal servitor of the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. And all the Vedic literatures give him directions towards that ultimate end. The Bhagavad Gita 15.15 confirms this statement. Like Vidura, an inquisitive conditioned soul must approach a bona fide spiritual master like Maitreya, and by intelligent inquiries must try to know everything about karma, fruitive activities, jnana, philosophical research for the supreme truth, and yoga, the linking process of spiritual realization. One who is not seriously inclined to put questions before a spiritual master need not accommodate a showbottle spiritual master. Nor should a person who may be a spiritual master for others pose to be so if he is unable to engage his disciple ultimately in the transcendental loving service of Lord Sri Krishna. Vidura was successful in approaching such a spiritual master like Maitreya, and he got the ultimate goal of life, bhakti unto Govinda. Thus, there was nothing to be known further about spiritual progress. Yavataha krittavan prashnan chatta kaushara vagrata Jataika Bhaktir Govinde Tevyascho Pararamaha. Translation. After asking various questions and becoming established in the transcendental loving service of Lord Krishna, Vidura retired from putting questions to Maitreya Muni. Mukham karoti bachalam pangam langayate girim yad kripataram mande shri gurundina charanam. So it is said in Bhagavatam, yascha budattamo loke yascha bude param gata tau ubo sukamede te klishyanti antarito jana. That there are two kinds of persons in this world who are happy. One is the mudha, the complete fool, who is satisfied in a life of sense gratification. The other is the one who has transcended yascha buddhi param gata. He has transcended buddhi. Buddhi means the intelligence, the intellect. So he is situated in spiritual happiness, as Prabhupada explains here, situated in transcendental loving service to Lord Sri Krishna. Thus he is tasting spiritual happiness. But klishyanti antarojana, in between these two, there are those who are neither completely ignorant, nor are they spiritually situated. And they feel unhappiness. They feel the miseries of material existence, the threefold miseries. What does that mean? That means that within this body and mind, I am suffering without any external input. I am suffering just by having this body and mind. When we sit in this body, we will feel itches and aches and pains, and we will feel uncomfortable. So these are miseries, and also our mind. Our mind acts in ways and thinks in ways that we do not like and brings us unhappiness. And then from beyond the body and mind, there are also pains coming. Other living entities, Adi Bhautika, are causing us pain, whether they be microbes or germs or other persons around us or dogs that bite us or whatever it may be. And then finally, there is Adi Daivika miseries, which means we suffer because of the conditions put upon us by the powers of nature. For instance, if it is too hot in the summer, then we suffer. When it is too cold in the winter, we suffer like that. So one who is in between complete ignorance and transcendental happiness, he perceives these threefold miseries, and thus he suffers. So philosophical inquiry is aimed, or we can just say philosophy, the enterprise of philosophy itself, is actually aimed at putting an end to these miseries. Therefore you see, Sri Sanatan Goswami, when he approached Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, after a long struggle, Sanatan Goswami had to go through a very long struggle in order to get himself free from his worldly duties and be able to approach Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So his first statement was, as he fell at the lotus feet of Lord Chaitanya, that people, common people, proclaim me to be a pundit. Pundit means a very learned person, because Sanatan Goswami was the minister of the Muslim king of Bengal, the Nawab Hussein Shah. So a minister to a king must be very, very intelligent. He must know how to give very expert advice to the king in government and politics and so on, administration. And for diplomatic work, Sanatan Goswami knew how to speak so many languages. Besides Bengali and Sanskrit, he was speaking Persian and Arabian and other languages. So he was celebrated as very learned. But he confessed to Lord Chaitanya, "I am so foolish that I believe them when they say that I'm learned. This is my problem." They tell me I'm learned, and I'm so foolish that I believe it. But actually, and then he put his questions. Ke ami, ke omaya jarita patraya. These are two very important questions. And they reveal why he felt himself unhappy. First of all, ke ami, that means in Bengali, who am I? He didn't know who he was. Of course, superficially, we all think that we are our body. We accept this, the material identity of this body as ourself. But this body is temporary. So the self is actually eternal. The self, being eternal, yearns for an eternal identity. Why am I forced to something? Because that anticipates the answer. If we ask, who am I? Then we, at least in Vedic circles, we anticipate the answer, you are spirit soul. You are eternal spirit soul. Fine. If I'm eternal spirit soul, that's very nice. But why do I suffer then? Why do I have to suffer here in this material world? So these were the inquiries of Sanatana Goswami. And they are inquiries pointed at ending suffering. So this is the starting point of all philosophy. That I understand I'm suffering. If I don't understand I'm suffering in this world, then I must be either, as I said, either a fool, complete ignoramus, or someone who is transcended. The intelligence, because it is through the intelligence, the intellect, that we perceive that I'm suffering. So someone who's above that, who's situated in spiritual happiness, he knows I'm not the body. So the body is suffering in different ways, but that's not me. So I'm either one of the two. I think in this city, Amsterdam, we won't find too many who have transcended intelligence. So, if I'm living in a place like Amsterdam and thinking I'm happy, probably that means I'm a complete fool. Hopefully, however, we do perceive that I'm suffering. And then we can begin the philosophical enterprise. So then, yes, now we come to philosophical inquiry, and that is of two types. There is one kind which is dedicated to distinguishing the difference between truth and illusion on the basis of my own sense perception and mental speculation. This is the path known as Aroha Panta, the path, the ascending path, that on my own strength I'm going to figure everything out. So this is one kind of philosophical enterprise. And I understand I'm suffering, but I'm going to figure out why. By the strength of my own perception and mental speculation. So the authority of this kind of philosophy is tarka. Tarka in Sanskrit means argument, logic, and logical argument. In other words, a philosopher in this school, he establishes his ideology, his ideas, on the basis of argument. On the basis of the strength of his sense perception and mental speculation. That comes out, that strength comes out as argument. You see, arguments based on what he sees and what he thinks. Now, there are so many philosophies that come out from this process. Practically the whole enterprise of Western philosophy is arising from this tarka, argument. I was having an exchange recently with Varnadi Das, who is the BBT translator for the Dutch books. So we were discussing, because he's looking for the proper way to translate modes of material nature, this expression which Prabhupada uses for the trigunas. So we were discussing this, and then I was telling him that, well, I think this famous Dutch philosopher, Baruch Spinoza, he has used this term, modes. And when I said he's very famous, then Varnadi replied, well, if you ask the average Dutch person, who is Spinoza? He'll think you're talking about the things up in the nose. Mucus in the nose. They don't know who is this Spinoza. Anyway, but Spinoza, he's one such philosopher who established an ideology on the basis of argument. So this process is not really established in knowledge. Because what is knowledge or truth? Knowledge means knowledge of the truth, real knowledge. It doesn't change. Truth means there is an objective reality out there, which we are meant to understand. But this process of establishing a philosophy by argument means that I put forward my own idea of the truth on the basis of what I see and think. So Spinoza did that, and then someone else came along and tried to knock down Spinoza's ideas with some ideas of his own. And this is how mundane philosophy goes on. Some philosopher comes out and presents something on the basis of what he sees and thinks, and it may become celebrated. He'll get his fans, philosophical fans, who say Baruch Spinoza ki jai, or Friedrich Nietzsche ki jai, or Kant ki jai, or so on and so forth. There's so many. But then someone else will come along with newer ideas, newer perceptions, and he'll become popular. So it is something like the modern world of entertainment and fashions, fashionable clothes, that something is in for a while and then goes out and something else becomes in. So this is all relative. It is not absolute. It is not final. So this cannot be actual knowledge, ultimate knowledge. So this is the Aroha Panta, the ascending process. Not really aimed at knowledge, rather aimed at power. Because prominent philosopher, he's powerful. He's influential. So, this is actually just another phase of materialism, because that is the whole material endeavor. To become powerful, to become famous, to become prominent, to lord it over others. And indeed, in this process, there is actually no real spiritual master-disciple relationship in the ultimate estimation. Srila Prabhupada, he was once walking to the Ganga in Mayapur, Sridhar Mayapur, accompanied by some of his disciples. And because the bank was steep to the water, then one disciple helped Srila Prabhupada come down by taking his arm. And then when Prabhupada came down next to the bank, then Prabhupada pushed that disciple. He pushed him away. And everyone was surprised. Why has Prabhupada done this? And then Prabhupada explained. He did this to illustrate this material relationship in this mundane form of philosophy between spiritual master and disciple. That the disciple takes help of the spiritual master. But when he feels himself strong enough to establish his own philosophy, then he pushes his so-called spiritual master away. This you see, for instance, even in the very ancient and classical Greek philosophy, the original Greek philosopher Socrates, he had a disciple, Plato. These are famous names. Practically everybody who's gone to school has heard these names. So Socrates was the first. He had a disciple, Plato. Now, Plato learned from Socrates, but Plato had his own ideas. So in establishing his own ideas, he pushed Socrates away. And then Plato had a disciple, Aristotle. And Aristotle also, he learned from Plato, but then got his own ideas and pushed Plato away. So this is how it goes in the material world. And you see in India also, among the Mayavadis, who are also doing the same thing. The Mayavadi philosophy is built upon my own perception and mental speculation. Actually, it is a negation of perception. You know, Mayavadi philosophy we call Nirvishesha Vada. So Vishesha, the word Vishesha in Sanskrit, means all the particular things that you see. The word means particularities. So as we sit in this room, I'm seeing so many particular people in here, and I'm seeing on this back wall particular paintings and particular designs, and we are in a particular room of this house. This is a particular house on a particular street, in a particular neighborhood, in a particular city, in a particular country, on a particular planet, in a particular universe. So this is all Vishesha Gyan. The particular things that we see, all the fine details. So, and it's unlimited, you see, because you can focus your particular vision down to atoms if you want. So any tiny little object you can, like your thumbnail, just take your thumbnail. It's a whole world of experience in this one thumbnail, counting all the atoms and studying them, and so you can endlessly investigate your own thumbnail and write libraries and libraries of books on it if you want. It's possible. So the Mayavadi philosophy negates all this. It's called Nirvishesha. It says, again, by the process of Anuman speculation, it says that all these particular features of this world are unreal. Therefore, it's useless to inquire into them. So then that negation, they consider that to be the final truth, the absence of all form and variety and qualities and activities. When all of that is erased, that's the truth. Zero. Nothing. So this is also based upon simply perception, or the negation of perception and mental speculation, this philosophy. Although it's passing as Vedic philosophy, but actually it's not. Anyway, in the Mayavadi philosophy, you find the same thing, that a disciple goes to a spiritual master and seemingly surrenders to him and inquires from him and gets knowledge, and then pushes him away. Because, you see, the goal of this Mayavadi philosophy is to become God. They accept God as that, the state of divine, as that state of zeroness, nirvishesha. So when one realizes that everything is nothing, then he has become absolute. He has become one with the impersonal God. So then when you become God, you don't need a spiritual master anymore. You don't need a guru. So they reject the guru. And there was one spiritual gathering, Mayavadi gathering, one actually very famous, popular Mayavadi guru was giving a talk. I think it was in Bombay. And there were banners advertising his lecture. And he was being advertised as the ex-disciple of Swami Shivananda. Such and such Maharaj, ex-disciple of Swami Shivananda. So this was his credit, that he used to be the disciple of the great Swami Shivananda, but not anymore, because now he's God. So Prabhupada, on the bank of the Ganges, he showed this by pushing the disciple away. And he said, "Is that very nice?" Prabhupada said, "Is that very nice? You have helped me. And now that I am on solid ground here, I push you away. I don't need you anymore." No. But this is the Mayavadi process. So as I said, this whole process actually is not really aimed at final knowledge. It's just aimed at showing that I am a great philosopher. I am a big jnani. I am God, because I know that everything is nothing. like that. So there's another kind of inquiry. Now, it's also known in the West. The name we know it of is the Avaroha Panta, descending process. In the West, there's a fancy name, which I'll explain, teleological inquiry. So the root, just to explain this word, because it's quite interesting, quite informative if we understand this. The root of teleological is telos, which in Greek means purpose. So it means inquiring into the purpose of everything. So this inquiry is based on the faith that everything in this world has an intelligent purpose. So if everything in this world has a real purpose, then that means everything in this world was designed by a supreme intelligence which gave everything a purpose. That is the faith behind this type of inquiry. So this inquiry is aimed at finding out who is that designer, who gave everything its purpose. And then at one stroke, you'll know the reason for everything. Srila Prabhupada gave a nice example from India. There was a book written by a Calcutta gentleman named Mr. Rutt. And this book is called Shah Jahan. Now, Shah Jahan is one of the great Mughal emperors in the Middle Ages of India. India was ruled from Delhi by a series of Muslim emperors, very powerful Muslim kings. And one of them was Shah Jahan. Now, Shah Jahan is still very well known today all around the world because he's the one who built the Taj Mahal. He built this as a monument to his favorite queen, Mumtaz. So, Shah Jahan, in this book of that name, is described as being very unhappy because he was imprisoned. He was put in prison by his own son, whose name was Aurangzeb. Now, Aurangzeb imprisoned his father, Shah Jahan, and took over the throne and made himself the emperor. So much of this book, Shah Jahan, is simply showing that Shah Jahan is sitting in house arrest, sitting in his room, locked up, and looking through the window at the Taj Mahal that he built, and thinking of his departed wife, Mumtaz, and lamenting. And meanwhile, the book is describing all of the terrible activities of Aurangzeb, his son, who took over the empire and who killed all his brothers, because Shah Jahan had other sons, other princes. Actually, Aurangzeb was the youngest, so he should not have become emperor. So in order to become emperor, he had to kill all his brothers. And in fact, at one day he came to Shah Jahan, came into his room and said, "I brought you a present." So he gave him a big, nicely wrapped box. And Shah Jahan was thinking, "Oh, perhaps my son's heart is changing. He's becoming nice to me now." So he opened the box and saw the head of his oldest son inside. So this was Aurangzeb, really bloodthirsty person. So when this book came out, Shah Jahan by Mr. Rutt, it created a lot of controversy in the literary world. People were questioning, why is the book called Shah Jahan? Because really, the one whose activities are described in the book are Aurangzeb. Because he was the one who was doing so many things, and Shah Jahan is just sitting in his room, looking at the Taj Mahal and crying. So, there was some debate, scholarly debate, that this book was titled wrongly. It should have been titled Aurangzeb instead of Shah Jahan. So the different articles and discussions were being exchanged on this point. Then finally, someone went to Mr. Rat and asked him, why did you name this book Shah Jahan? Was it just perhaps a mistake? And he gave a very elaborate explanation. No, I deliberately named this book Shah Jahan. The book is really about Shah Jahan. Because he is having to suffer. He is sitting in his room suffering all of the evil activities of his own son, Aurangzeb. So Aurangzeb's activities are described. But the actual point of the book is to show how Shah Jahan is suffering, the result of all these activities. So then when that became clear, everyone was satisfied. Yes, now we understand why this book is called Shah Jahan. So Prabhupada told this story to show that if you want to actually know the purpose of anything, then you should go to the author of that thing, the creator of that thing, and ask him. So similarly, if one wants to know the purpose of this world, the purpose of this body I have, the purpose of my very self, one has to go to he from whom all of this comes and inquire from him. So that is the Vedanta philosophy. Atato Brahma Jignasha. Now that you've come to this human form of life and you have a nice intellect by which to inquire into the truth, so you should inquire into Brahman. Brahman means the source of everything. Inquire, make that your subject of inquiry. Not this other business of just trying to understand on the basis of your own perception and mental speculation without any reference to the higher cause. Just try to understand what is real and what is not real around you. What is true, what is false, what is right, what is wrong. This is the mundane philosophy. That type of philosophical inquiry, there's no end. It just means endless argument. I will think this way, and someone else will come along and say, no, you're wrong. It's like this. And then who is accepted as right or wrong? It's just on the basis of skill of argument. We'll have a big debate, and if I can talk my opponent into a corner and he becomes speechless, then I have won. See, like boxing, you know, Muhammad Ali then dances around the ring. I have won. I am the greatest. He used to say this. I am the greatest. So this is going on in philosophy too. At least the type of philosophers, they're having a big boxing match of words, and one of them wins. I am the greatest. I am the philosopher. But then just like Muhammad Ali, he got older and older, and then someone came along and finally knocked him down. And then he said, I am the greatest. This is how it goes. So this does not actually establish the ultimate truth of things. It's just an endless argument. So this teleological process, inquiring into the purpose, not just into whether something is real or not real, or right or wrong, or like this, but actually establish, to inquire into why we are here, what is the purpose of everything. Then we have to turn to he from whom everything has come. We have to ask him, why did you make this world like this? Why did you put us in this world? Huh? And then we will find out why we are suffering. Because just like I have this body, or we all have our physical human bodies. Now, why are we suffering in them? Why do we feel uncomfortable in these bodies? Because actually, we don't know what to do with them. We don't know what the purpose is. We may think, because we don't have any better information, that the purpose of this body is to just enjoy. I have the senses, and there are things in this world which make my senses feel good. So the purpose of my life is to just connect my senses with those nice things and feel happy, feel pleasure, sensual pleasure. So I may be thinking that this is the purpose of life. But when I do this, what happens? I suffer. Isn't it, Brian? Yes, we suffer. So then I must be doing something wrong. I'm thinking that this is my purpose. But when I do it, I suffer. So then I should conclude, I must have misunderstood the purpose. So I can't figure out the purpose on my own. Huh? So therefore I have to turn to higher authority. And higher authority means guru, Guru is the representative of God, and God is the origin of everything. So Guru, spiritual master, he explains to us what is the purpose of this body. And the purpose of this body we've heard here in this purport. It is to serve Krishna. And when one engages the body in devotional service to Krishna, and then, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Mamevye prapadyante mayametam tarantite. By surrendering unto me, then by my grace, sarva durgani tarishyasi, Lord Krishna says in 18th chapter also, by my grace you will cross over all the miseries of material life. So this is how one becomes free of suffering. So by understanding that this body, this mind, everything that we have that makes up our individuality, and this world around us, and all of the beings in this world, come from Krishna, and are actually the property of Krishna, then I become detached. This is how one becomes free of suffering. One becomes free of suffering by detachment. As long as I am attached to this body, then I will suffer. But if I become detached from it, then I am free from suffering. So detachment is very easily accomplished by simply admitting that the body is not mine, it's Krishna's. Because Krishna made this body. Krishna made this world. I cannot lay any claim here. So my purpose then is simply to serve. So this immediately, by doing so, this allows us to cross over the ocean of material suffering. So in this way, the buddhi, the intellect, is meant to be used. It's compared. This is a comparison given in 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's meant to be used like the sharp edge of an axe. You know, an axe has this metal head with a sharp edge. And attachment is compared to a tree. So you have to chop down the tree of attachment with this sharp-edged analytical intellect, understanding the real purpose of everything. Now, here's an important point. In order to chop down a tree, you need more than just an axe head. If you just have the metal head of an axe, you won't be able to chop down that tree. You're going to hold this axe head in your hand and go like that on the side of the tree? No, you won't be able to chop it down. You have to take a branch from that tree and make it into a handle and insert the handle into the hole in the axe head. And then you have a very good tool to chop down the tree. So this analogy is explaining what is called yukta vairagya. Renunciation by engaging this body in Krishna's service. You see, taking the branch from the tree means the tree is this body, what we are attached to. So one should take this body, take the skills, the talents of this body, the nature of this body, and engage it in Krishna's service. This is called buddhi yoga. If I am endowed by nature with certain talents, let's say I have mathematical ability, or I have musical ability, or artistic ability, or I have a big mouth, I like to talk, or whatever it may be, then in order to become detached from this ability, I should take this ability and with intelligence use it in Krishna's service. Not suppress it. There are some who think that the spiritual path is just to suppress. In Christian history, the history of the Christian church, in the early phase of it, there were persons who tried to give up sinful life, the worldly life, by very morbid austerities. There was a kind of monk, I think this was especially in Eastern Europe, a kind of monk. They took the vow whereby they would chain themselves. They would have a neck.
Necklace?
Something like a necklace, but you know what I mean. This, like a collar, an iron collar. Yes, that's exactly what I mean. An iron collar that would be fitted around their neck by a blacksmith, and then it would be attached to a chain, and then the chain would be attached. It would be anchored in a sewer underground. So, in other words, he would be chained in an underground sewer where all the waste products, stool and urine would be flowing. And he couldn't get out. So he'd have to live there amidst stool and urine. And he would, there would be some window or something above in the street, and he would cry out in misery, cry out to God, and people would throw food down there and he would catch it and eat. So the idea was, if one is chained up like that, then one won't do anything bad. You see, one won't do any sins. And he'll just pray to God and lament his misery and in this way become holy. This was the idea. There was another kind of monk who used to take a vow to sit upon a high pinnacle called a stylus. In the middle of some city. In the 1920s, there was a fashion of sitting on flagpoles. So it was something like that. Of course, that was just for fun. That was just, they would just try to outdo each other how long they could sit on a flagpole. But this was actually a vow that the monks would take. They would go on top of this stylus and just sit there. And then again, they couldn't do anything. They could just pray, and people would throw up some food, and they would try to catch it, and maybe once a week they might get a little, catch a little bread. Just imagine, they'd be throwing up stuff and it would fall and, and then you'd see it on the ground around you, nothing to eat. So these were attempts at becoming holy by suppressing the body. But this is not the process in Krishna consciousness. The example is, again, take a branch from the tree. Take the talents of this body, attach it to the accent of buddhi, of inquiry, understanding the source of everything, Krishna, and understanding his purpose, and then use it. Use it for the service of the Lord. In this way, you cut down the tree of attachment. You become detached from this world. So that is the process of Krishna consciousness. This is what we do in ISKCON. Devotees who surrender their lives to Krishna, they do not chain themselves up in sewers or go sitting on flagpoles. But if one has, as I said, mathematical talent, then he can become the temple treasurer and use his abilities in keeping track of Krishna's Lakshmi, the income and the expenditure. If he has musical abilities, then he can become a good kirtan singer. If he has a big mouth, then he can give lectures like I do. Like that. Whatever he can contribute, he engages in Krishna's service. Now, this does not mean, however, when we say chopping down the tree of attachment, that then at one point when you transcend the material body, then you do nothing. Then all service stops, because now you're just there, and then you can just be here now, as someone said. No, actually, as Lord Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, karmajam buddhiyuktahi palang chaktva manishina, he says those who are actually learned, actual philosophers, they engage their karma, karma jam buddhi yuktahi, they engage their karma, their abilities, palam chaktva manishina, in the service of Lord, giving up the fruit of their work to Krishna. The fruit of their work goes to Krishna. And in this way, karma bandha vinir mukta, they become free of birth and death, padam gachchanti anamayam, and achieve the supreme goal. Now, what is that supreme goal? This is what we must understand. What do they achieve by doing this? They do not achieve some static state, inactive state. No, they achieve the state of transcendental devotional service. You see, devotional service has two phases, explained by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. The first phase, the lower phase, is called upaya. Upaya means the means by which one attains the goal. And that's devotional service and practice, sadhana bhakti. We are now practicing to serve Krishna, learning, following rules and regulations, and learning day by day to give more and more and more to Krishna, more physically, more of our physical energy, more of our mental energy. So in this way, by giving more and more and more to Krishna, then we are, yes, cutting down the tree of attachment to this body. That is actually the goal here in sadhana bhakti, to become 100% engaged on all levels, subtle and gross, in the Lord's service 24 hours a day with no reserve energy anywhere left over for Maya. So this is what we're practicing at. This is called sadhana bhakti. And then when one actually becomes established in pure devotional service, giving everything 100% to Krishna, then it's not that the service suddenly stops. Oh, now you've done it. Okay, now you just go on a permanent vacation from devotional service. No. Then one comes to the higher phase of devotional service, which Bhaktivinoda Thakur calls the pal. The pal means the result. And that is devotional service in bhava and prema, in ecstasy and pure love of God, as is being done in the spiritual world. Here we see, whenever I give lecture here, I'm blessed by seeing this beautiful painting right in front of me of Sri Sri Radha and Krishna and the gopis and their loving exchanges. So this is pala bhakti. This is the goal of bhakti, to serve Krishna padam gacchanti anamayam in the spiritual world, eternally, in love and in ecstasy. So this is how one makes progress in devotional service. So progress means to utilize one's resources, body, mind, everything, in pleasing the Lord. Yes, this is actually how one advances. This is the symptom of advancement, that I am becoming more and more enthusiastic to please Krishna by my service. In the beginning, our purpose may be something else. We are serving Krishna, doing devotional service, but with the intention of getting free of suffering, with the intention of rising above lusty desires which causes so much trouble. Our aim is to become purified. So, but actually, real advancement means that I'm aiming at giving pleasure to Krishna. So the more I become situated in this consciousness, then the more I am padam gacchanti anamayam, the more I am attaining this supreme goal of life. Because the devotees in the spiritual world, that is their only purpose. They have no problem with mind and senses. They're not suffering there. They're not inquiring into why I'm suffering in the spiritual world. Their inquiry is one thing: how to please Krishna more. That's all. That is the focus of all their activities. So this is actually the path of advancement: to come away from obsession with my own problems and come towards one thing, simply pleasing Krishna. So, Krishna has come in this age of Kali as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Radha Krishna Nahyanya. He is Radha and Krishna together in one personality, Lord Gauranga, the golden avatar. And he is offering us all the opportunity to serve him in this Sankirtan movement. So advancement in Krishna consciousness in terms of Lord Chaitanya's movement means that we go out and we preach His mission by Harinam Sankirtan, by distributing Srila Prabhupada's books, by distributing prasadam. But advancing in giving pleasure, in the consciousness of giving pleasure to Lord Chaitanya in these activities. This is progress. In the beginning, as I said, we may take up these activities because we're in distress and we want to get free of distress. So this is the cause of our enthusiasm. We find that our mind and senses are so disturbed, so full of crazy urges and desires. But when we jump into an enthusiastic kirtan, then all of that goes away and we feel better. So then we're enthusiastic for kirtan for that reason, to get free of our own craziness. So that's beginning. That is this upaya bhakti, devotional service as the means to attain the goal. But the pala bhakti, the advanced stage, is that one is enthusiastic just to please Lord Chaitanya. Prabhupada actually put it this way. He said, Lord Chaitanya has a headache. He has a headache worrying about all the fallen conditioned souls in this Kali Yuga, as we saw yesterday. Just think, if those people down there that we saw in the Queen's Day were your parts and parcels, you'd also be worried. So Lord Chaitanya is worried. So our mission is to relieve Lord Chaitanya of his headache by pleasing him through giving these fallen, most unfortunate conditioned souls his mercy in the form of Harinam, in the form of Krishna Prasadam, in the form of Srila Prabhupada's books. So the more enthusiastic we become to please Lord Chaitanya by executing his mission, then the more advanced we are in devotional service. And then the more we become eligible for Lord Chaitanya, for the reward that Lord Chaitanya has come to give us, the reward of Krishna Prema. As we see, this is Krishna Prema, right, depicted in this picture. So Lord Chaitanya, just as he revealed himself to Sri Ramananda Roy as Radha and Krishna, so for those who please Lord Chaitanya by heaps and heaps of pious activities in the Sankirtan mission, preaching Krishna consciousness, then Lord Chaitanya becomes pleased to reveal his form as Sri Radha and Krishna and invite the devotee to enter into his eternal pleasure pastimes in Goloka Vrindavan. So this is the actual goal of inquiry. So yes, at one point, we may, just as Vidura is described here, he has become satisfied in hearing about his position as servant of Krishna. So he has stopped his inquiry, that inquiry, Kayami, Kayomaya, Jarita Patraya, who am I, why am I suffering? At one point, there is no longer need to inquire into those things. But that doesn't mean inquiry stops. It doesn't mean that the relationship with the spiritual master stops. It simply shifts into a higher dimension. And then one inquires, how can I please Krishna more and more and more? Huh? All right. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Are there any questions? Yes?
So if my philosophy one finds that everything is designed, and that there is a design, and then one can also further inquire as well, who designed the design?
Who designed the designer? Why should the designer have a designer? Why should the source of everything have a source? What is the logic of that? Why is that? Why do you consider that to be logical inquiry? If something is the source, if there is a source to everything, now why should that source have another source behind it?
Well, if you postulate that there is a source of everything, but if you go up through Aroha Mantra, you say, what is the source? I see creation, so there must be a creator. Then you can also, with the same logic, what is the source of the creator?
But if he is the source of everything, then that's where it stops. Well, if you realize that he's the source of everything, then it's more than just faith. If you've actually understood how it, first of all, what is everything, and then its connection to the source, its purpose, then there is no other purpose left. Then you'd have to have, following your logic, you'd have to develop a faith in some other purpose. So actually, what you're talking about is a process of faith, blind faith. You understand what I'm saying?
No.
You see, once you've established reality as having a source, reality means everything that you can know. And you've understood the connection of everything within reality to that source, its purpose, then all questions have been answered. Unless you want to cultivate a faith, well, maybe there's some other reality which I do not perceive at all. That's faith, isn't it? All right. So let's be realistic. I'm talking about being realistic. Realistic means that everything comes from a source. So when we understand that, and that's practical, when you understand the practical relationship between everything and the source, everything has a purpose, everything is meant to be engaged in the purpose, in the service of that source,